And good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Heretics Hour tonight. I've lost track of time here, and I just ran to my spot here and put my earphones on to start the show. I want to welcome you to a new live edition of the Heretics Hour. I'm your host, Carolyn Yeager, and I'm back after a week off, which really felt good. How I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. It seemed like having that much time without doing programs seems like a real big break, although the end of it also sort of comes fast, but at the same time, I'm happy to be back doing another show. I guess I always have so much I want to say that after a week's not saying anything, I'm got a whole lot backed up in me. I'm happy to be with you here tonight, and I want to start off by reading a letter from Charlie from Canada. Charlie wrote to me this past week, I got it, and he said, "Hi, Carolyn. After downloading all of your shows and listening to a good many of them, it is time for me to show my appreciation of all the hard work you have done for a good many years without missing a beat. Your good German genes," he has to be German, "your good German genes are manifested through your truthfulness, courage, your sense of duty, and your capacity for hard, sustained work. It pleases me that you defend Adolf Hitler. His more than human efforts to preserve European mankind from destruction makes him, in my eyes, the greatest human being that I am aware of. I'm glad that you attacked the Holocaust head on. The fact that nothing makes the Jews squeal louder is proof of the correctness of this approach. Please take care, Charlie." Well, Charlie sent something in appreciation too, which was nice of him, and he's very anonymous. That's all I know is that he calls himself Charlie. No, don't know anything more about him. But I'm real happy that someone like Charlie will write to me, and I have people like Charlie listening who really appreciate Adolf Hitler as much as I do. And that's something that I would like to just talk about Adolf Hitler all the time, if I could, and talk about why the Holocaust is a lie, and talk about the Third Reich and so on. But race issues are just as important, and the loss of our homelands too, so I can't keep myself from going into these things too. And tonight, I guess I have a little bit of all of it. I'm looking at these issues through the lens of what we are getting from proclaimed pro-white personalities who use the internet and radio programs, etc., to educate rather than entertain you listeners and readers out there who make up their audience. I'm considering how well qualified they are to carry on this education concerning Adolf Hitler and the Holocaust. I'm spelling that with the H-O-L-O-C, capital C-O-S-T. That's my new spelling for a while. And just sticking with these two things, Adolf Hitler and the Holocaust, how well qualified are people who are jumping in and talking about it? So I'm starting off where I ended up a week ago Saturday with Mark Weber. Since that program, in which I devoted only the last half hour to Mark Weber, and I knew I needed to do more. I didn't have time to say all the things I had planned to say. So I thought I should, since I wasn't going to be on the radio for another week, I thought I needed to write an article trying to put the IHR problem in more perspective and add a little some of the things that I had left out. And so I did that, and I posted it at my Carolyn Yeager website and at the White Network as a blog so that people could write comments, and also just to, because I wanted to put it there too, to get more exposure for it. And it has attracted going on 800 reads by now just on my Carolyn Yeager website. So there is plenty of interest in it for all over the world. And every time I've written about Mark Weber, it gets a lot of reads. It gets a lot of attention. So people are not unaware of the IHR and the problem with the IHR and the controversy surrounding Mark Weber, which a lot of people on the radio today don't, on internet radio today, some of the younger people don't seem to be aware of. And none of the information that I presented in this article and in my program a week ago Saturday is new. It's all old news, but nothing was done about it. Nothing has been done about it. Not that people, there weren't those who tried to do something about it, but it was not possible. And now this, as I kind of said, already said, a new younger crop of internet personalities has been spawned, and they really have no idea about all that went down at the IHR. And I suspect they think it's not that important. They think, let's just move on from here. Well, my answer to that is that is like saying, what happened during the 1930s and 40s happened. We can't do much about it now, so we can't do anything about it now. So why dwell on it? Let's go forward from here. You see, that doesn't really work, does it? Because you're going forward then from a false position and in a state of ignorance. Why the IHR is so important is because it has been the only institute for historical revision in the sense that we think about revision, in the sense of revising the falsehoods and lies that have been put down, that has been created as the, in the history, according to the Allied victors of World War II. And it was also an institute that was basically all about Holocaust revisionism, although it also carried on some historical revisionism. And the two go together, just naturally, are intertwined. But Mark Weber wants us to do just that. He wants us to go forward in a state of ignorance when it comes to the IHR. Not when it comes to the World War II history, but when it comes to the IHR, he really would rather if nobody ever thought about all that went on since its founding in 1978 or 79 and through the 80s and 90s, putting out this journal, which was successful and it was wonderful. Of course, none of this stuff has a big audience. I'm not saying that it was like mainstream magazine, but it was successful and things were there was just so much activity. Everybody felt excited about it. And in the 80s, it was like revisionism was making such great strides. And we had these really bright people writing, researching, doing incredible research and correcting the record and writing all kinds of things, more factually than had been before. And that's what got the Holocaust industry very nervous finally. And then they tried to come down on it harder. That is true. However, it didn't have to collapse like it did. Well, that story is something that really needs to be known, and I tried to present some of that in that article that I imagine probably most people who listen to this have read or will read then, which is good. You know, my feeling, as I said in that article, is that Mark Weber should not be treated as a hero or as a great asset to the revisionist community or as somebody who has contributed and continues to contribute a great deal because of the part he played in destroying this, what I was just describing as the great activity and so on at the IHR. And this is what people either don't know about or would rather just forget about because they don't like to be, they don't like to denounce people or they don't like to be angry at people. They don't like to be unkind and they think that what they've heard from Mark Weber they like and therefore that's good enough and let the past be in the past. So, I want to jump right in here and talk about some of these internet personalities and through probably no fault of his own, but Kyle Hunt, enabled Mark Weber beautifully with his interview on 11/11/2013 on his, I always think of Resistance, that network that he runs with the R. I'm surprised I suddenly can't think of what it is, but I will think of it. And he had Mark Weber on as a guest, and He gave Weber an unqualified, praise-filled introduction, as though he was rubbing shoulders with the elite of white nationalism. And I can only believe that it was because of the above stated reasons that Kyle Hunt does not know enough to interview Mark Weber. He is not, therefore, he is not qualified to educate his listeners on the subject of IHR. Now, he can certainly talk in general about these things and about the Holocaust and about World War II and about Hitler and so on. And he's got all the right attitudes toward it. And so I don't mean to be insulting here, but I'm going to be real tough in my approach tonight, because I think that there's too much going on that people feel is helpful and that people are listening to and being satisfied with, when they really don't get the whole story. They don't get all the truth. And that causes us to be stuck in a place where people continuing to put out a lot of bad information. I'll get to that. And before I go into Kyle's show, which I'm going to go in a little bit of detail about it, Rodney Martin has also now been lionizing Mark Weber on his programs, on Rodney's programs. Although I don't know how many people listen to them, but Rodney has shifted around quite a bit in his view of Mark Weber. And Rodney Martin used to be a financial contributor to IHR, and so Weber always made him welcome, because that's his main concern, is raising money, which all goes to him except for what is needed to run the very tiny activities of the IHR that are going on these days. But Rodney Martin knows all the truth about Mark Weber, and he certainly discussed it with me enough times, but for some political reasons, he's now taken a new position on Weber and says that they're going to be collaborating on some programs of some kind, some projects. Okay, that's all I'm going to say about Rodney Martin. Because, Rodney Martin and I basically agree on most all issues concerning Hitler and the Third Reich. I think Rodney Martin doesn't know all that much about Holocaust revisionism, but he's got the right attitude toward it, but I don't think he knows as much, but he specializes in National Socialist lore. And on almost everything, like I was reading some comments by him today on this debate that I'm going to talk about in the second hour between the John Friend debate issue, and I thought, I'm very much in agreement with Rodney, more than almost anybody else that's writing on there. So I really shouldn't, I'm nearly not an enemy to Rodney Martin. But I will say what I think about these things. And so that's all I'm going to say about Rodney. I think it is. Now, some of the things said by Weber on this show with Kyle Hunt on November 11th is that in answer to questions, Weber said, basically, some things like this. The IHR is based on historical revisionism. History is based on power. Well, that's something I've been saying for a long time. And then he made a point that we see how, here at the IHR, we see how history is reflected in current events. Well, I just want to comment that he always speaks in terms of we. I don't know what we he's talking about, because clearly, he's the only person there. So if he was being really honest and straightforward, he would say I. Because if he's including his board of directors, they're not involved in anything that's going on there. They're just four people, as far as I know, has been reduced to that. And he's on the board, so he makes the fifth person. That, I think, is the minimum that you can have. And I believe that's what he's got now. And they are not people who are even involved in these issues. They're just people that Mark has asked to be on the board, and they just do whatever he says. So there's nobody but him, but he's always talking about we, as though he's the director of a functioning group there that's really going out to do things. He has some people who will come and work with him, or who cooperate with him, and that's probably why he feels like he can say we, but we don't know who they are. We don't know their names. They're not listed on the website or on any of the official papers that are filed, and there's nobody getting any salary there, nobody, except for Mark Weber. So this, you know, what my point here, though, also is that he's very vague, as usual. He has the goals and the objectives of the IHR. He's got them vagued down, if I can say that, as much as possible, to where he doesn't really say anything, you know. And he doesn't ever mention Holocaust anymore. He may have that word once on his about page, but I didn't go back to look at it since the last time I looked at it, which was a while back. But I know that at that time, what I found was that it really came down to the purpose of the IHR is to help bring about world peace. I mean, how vague can you get? And that's on purpose, because he doesn't want to commit to saying, like it used to do when he wasn't running it, more explicitly what they were all about, what they wanted to do, what they were trying to do. And then he said that we cover a whole range of topics that are relevant for today. Today. Not just, and these are his exact words on the program, not just World War II, not just the Holocaust, but a vast range of topics that are really relevant for Americans today. So he's implying there that World War II and the Holocaust are not as relevant as these other issues that he doesn't name, but only calls them a vast range of topics. And also he always speaks of Americans. It's always Americans, for some reason. I don't know why. I think he'd be reaching out beyond Americans, but I think that he gets money from Americans. And I don't think he probably doesn't get any money from anybody outside of the United States. He doesn't, you know, of what he has left of supporters, they're probably all Americans. But then, you know, in the program, they both go on to agree, Kyle and Mark, about different things. And they don't get into any really critical thoughts. They don't get into any real deeper or profound or critical things. They're saying what the general things that we all know. So I'm saying that the description of the show is like nothing new. There's nothing new there. Now, there doesn't have to be something new there, but who is listening to, here it is, Renegade Broadcasting. Sorry, I couldn't remember that before. Who is listening to these shows on Renegade Broadcasting? You think the average public is listening to them so that they would get something from this generalized talk about the war and the history and the Holocaust and the IHR, that they would learn something from this? No, they're probably, I can't imagine that they're listening. I imagine that it's people like listen to me, and people that listen to all of these kinds of programs are listening, and they would like to hear something little more than the usual patter that we hear all the time, that everybody's got down pretty well. At least people, well-spoken people like Kyle Hunt has down real well. He is a good speaker, and he can just say these things in a very good way and easy to listen to way. And Mark Weber also, he's a good speaker in this way. He chooses his words carefully, but he's been saying these same things over and over. I mean, what he said on the show sounded to me, much of it, like I heard exactly on some of his podcasts that he's done. So he's got the script down. He might even have a script in front of him, or two or three or so. So that's what we hear. We hear the same thing that we've already heard. But a lot of people, or some people, wrote comments to that show and seemed to be very pleased with it, and thought it was very good, and they liked Mark Weber and all. And this is where the problem is. When we accept people like this and don't look at what they're really saying as closely as we should, I'm going to point some of this out. Mark Weber says that, well, this is kind of out of context here, but he said the victims of Stalin far outnumber the victims of Hitler. And I noted that down because I thought it reveals something very wrong when you keep yourself in the middle of the road like this by saying, by implying that there were victims of Hitler just like there were victims of Stalin, but Stalin, there were more victims of Stalin. Now, I've heard this so many times, but it doesn't really help anything. It doesn't to say that, well, Stalin murdered, you know, 100 million people and Hitler only murdered 6 million if those. So why aren't they going after Stalin? Well, people think that's a real good point. But I've never seen that it has helped anything when it comes to Hitler, because you're still painting Hitler as people being victims of this man. Now, Kyle, at some point, said, ask a good question. He did have good questions, but he didn't really get answered by Mark Weber. And let's see here. Kyle says, do you have any kind of rough estimates as to number of Jews who suffered and or died? And Weber did not answer that. He sidestepped it. He sidestepped a lot of things, and they weren't even that difficult of questions. And he starts telling Kyle about the Bergen-Belsen. He said, well, I'll try to answer it this way. He said, that's difficult to say, you know, there's a lot of blah, blah, but I'll answer it this way. And, you know, he sounds very authoritative and easy to listen to, and like we're really learning something here. So, I mean, he sounds good when he says it, but when you analyze what he said, you see, that's when you find out that he's avoiding ever saying anything. He's avoiding answering questions like this. And I think in large part because he doesn't even know. He doesn't really know that much. And I'm going to get into that shortly, but he doesn't know as much as people think he does. And that's why people ask him questions like this. And they never get an answer, but they might think they got it. Maybe he's able to finesse the whole thing. But he has no idea. He is not an expert on Holocaust. He maybe used to have more to say about it back in the days when he was following around with the revisionists. But since he has left that, or they've left him or whatever, he doesn't keep up with it. And he's probably forgotten a whole lot of it, but he knows enough to say what he wants to say. So what he wants to say here is that, for example, at Bergen-Belsen and other camps, when the Allies arrived to liberate the camps, they found many dead and dying prisoners. And it just looked awful because, you know, we know the reasons, I think he gave them, but, you know, that the bombing of Germany had caused the destruction of the infrastructure, and there was no food to deliver. They had bombed the plumbing and the electrical systems and so on. They destroyed so much of the whole camps were in terrible disarray, and then started typhus got worse, and so a lot of people were dying. They weren't able to take care of the dead and cremate them, or they couldn't bury them because they had disease. And all of this, and they found all this, and they made a big deal out of it. That's all true. That's how he answered that question, that do you have any idea to the number of Jews who really suffered badly or who died? No numbers from Mark Weber. And then he goes on and goes directly into the Anne Frank story and how she died of typhus, as though we don't know that, and we need to spend time listening to that. And this got pretty tiresome. We didn't get any more than that out of that. So after that, I think Kyle made some comments about how these numbers have been played up and they're blown up and there weren't that many of them. And he thought that, according to the Red Cross numbers, about 300,000 Jews were killed in these, or died in these camps throughout the whole time. And what did Weber say to that? Well, I don't know what he started out with, but he said, well, I don't want to play down the fact that there was an enormous policy of repression and killing of many Jews during World War II. That's Weber's answer. And this is not the first time I've heard this. I mean, I hear this from him all the time. But you don't hear him very often talking about this, but he says this when he is talking about it. And he's written it too. And notice he says enormous. There was an enormous policy of repression and killing. Repression and killing of many Jews during World War II. I don't know, he says many. You know, what is many? A majority of the Jews? Or he doesn't make that clear either. And this entirely gives the impression that the Jews were treated very unfairly. The Jews suffered and were killed, because he uses the word killing, by the Germans. And, you know, there's, after you say something like that, you can't very well come back and minimize it too much. But he, what he says after that is, but the important point is not what happened. What's important is what we emphasize, that the point of the war was to kill every German possible by bombing civilians. Well, now he can't take on the question of how many Jews. He's afraid of the Jews, or he's afraid of being wrong, or he just doesn't know anything. He has no answers for any of this. So he wants to now say, that's not important, the numbers there. What's important is that the Allies wanted to kill every German. So even though Germans were killing Jews, is what he's saying, the Allies were wanting to kill every German, and they were bombing Germans, so they were doing just as bad, if not worse, or maybe worse, according to him. So he says the point is what the U.S. was fighting for in World War II was the New World Order, a universalist egalitarian order presided over by the U.S. and Soviet Union. Well, he's not wrong about that, but that's what he wants to talk about now, instead of talking about revisionism and talking about actual points about the Holocaust, and even points about what was happening in the war. He wants to just bring it right to the overall picture that the United States was fighting for this New World Order that they were going to preside over. And that's exactly what Greg Johnson was arguing in his infamous essay that I'm sure a lot of you will remember from a couple of years ago, and saying that, well, but the Americans and the British and so on were worse. But they don't want, they won't excuse in any way the Germans for what they were doing. They have to make the Germans guilty too, somehow. You know, they never will say, they never will do this. And I want to tell you that in my opinion, Germany is innocent throughout the whole deal. They're innocent. They were operating in self-defense the whole time. And, you know, from the end, even during World War II. And then, I mean, World War I is what I meant to say. And then, you know, what happened between the wars. And then they, the rise of Adolf Hitler in the 20s and 30s. Then the powers that be went to war against Germany in order to stop its great success that it was having. Germany had incredible success. I'm not going to go into that. You know that. And in order to stop that, they went to war. Now, Mark Weber knows that. But that's the only part he wants to focus on, because he doesn't want to get into any kind of absolving of Germans in Germany the way I'm doing. He won't excuse the Germans. He will only point out that the Allies were worse. That's not enough, in my opinion, you see. People say, well, that's good, that's good. And for a lot of people, that's as far as they go, and that's as far as they think it needs to go. But actually, if you're going to get to the bottom of this, you have to go farther than that. And then Kyle brings up the Anne Frank story again after, I guess because Weber had brought it up, and talks about the ballpoint pen story. And see, he doesn't know that that's not really a good point to make, because they say that ballpoint pens weren't invented yet at that time, but they were invented. It's just that most people didn't, they weren't widely circulated. And most people didn't have one, and probably this girl and so on family wouldn't have had one. But it's not like it's impossible. So that has been pointed out, and that's not the best argument to use about Anne Frank. That's not the best thing to say about the Anne Frank story. But that's, see, again, Kyle doesn't know any better. He reads these things and he repeats them. And Weber doesn't help him out. He sidesteps that again. He's not interested in the ballpoint pen story, and he wants to get back to the political arguments. And one thing I've noticed from listening carefully to this and to other things by Weber's is that that's what he's interested in today. He wants to talk about the politics of today. He does that in his news and comment newsletter that he sends out. And he does it on the website, on the IHR website now. It's all about current events. And that's what, and he likes, you know, what's in the newspapers and so on. And that's what he's interested in. He's not interested in what the IHR was about when it was founded. And it's still relevant. It's not like, well, it's not even relevant anymore, so it's a good idea to move on to current events. It's because he doesn't want to do that stuff anymore. He doesn't want to do history and Holocaust anymore, so he changed it. But the interesting thing that you should know is that when he was involved in the formulating the complaints against Willis Carto and getting Willis Carto out of being the controller of the IHR back in the early 90s, the argument that he formulated was that Willis Carto wanted the journal of the Institute of Historical Review, which was still going at that time. Well, it was going strong through the 80s and still in 1990 when this whole thing started going on. He said that Willis Carto wanted to turn the journal from being just about Holocaust revisionism to also including historical revisionism. And Weber was one of the ones who was saying, that's wrong. We don't want that. He's turning against, we're all Holocaust revisionists and we want... He's changing things. And then as soon as Weber got control, he very shortly decided he wasn't interested in the Holocaust anymore. And actually, Willis Carto immediately started another magazine, and he included Holocaust revisionism. He included historical revisionism. And that magazine, the Barnes Review, is still going today. And the journal went down the tubes as soon as Weber got hold of it. I wrote about that in my article, so I don't need to say any more about that. But the point is that Weber changed his tune from what he was accusing Carto of, which Carto had the right idea, but Weber was just encouraging the other revisionists to be difficult about that. So I don't know what Weber is afraid of, but I really think it's not so much about that. You know, Weber is following David Irving in this. I was going to say that Weber always wants to get back to the political arguments, and he wanted to talk about Churchill and Churchill's very bad record. Well, it's really easy to denigrate Winston Churchill. Nobody thinks Winston Churchill was any good anymore except British diehard patriots. But this is a position that David Irving has pioneered. And Weber is just following David Irving. I guess I could put in here that Weber is not an original thinker. Weber is not even a real researcher that people seem to put a lot of articles. His articles, and he puts information together very well. That's his best point. He wrote, there were revisionists at that time who were doing real research, you know, going to archives, looking things up, and Weber, for the most part, took what they had discovered and what they were writing and what they wrote books about and so on, and wrote individual articles for the journal, and these articles are now on the archive section of the Institute website, of the IHR website, along with articles by a lot of other people. And Weber, people think Weber wrote most of the articles, but that is not true. But he now features his own articles a lot in his comments and on the website. He doesn't feature the articles of the others as in the same way, but they are there. They're all there, and you can go and look at them and find out for yourself. So Weber wants to talk about the power of Jews in the United States and immigration that the Jews are behind and current events. And he even started talking about the California senators that got so carried away talking about politics on this program with Kyle Hunt and got talking about Joseph Biden and so on. And people like this. People enjoy it. People know this is important. So they don't mind that he moves on to that. But what they don't notice is that he's ignoring the other And he doesn't really want it brought up, because the fact is, as I've already said, he really doesn't know that much about it, and he doesn't have any answers. And he's not willing to give the kind of answers that some revisionists are coming up with either. So, okay, so that's my criticism of, I hope, now Kyle Hunt said that he was going to be having, thought it was a great program, and he hoped to have Weber back on again for a longer time. This was only 1 hour, and I hope, this was before, of course, I wrote my article, and I hope that Kyle Hunt has read it. I assume that he has, and I hope that he's looked at those links that I linked to by Garamar Rudolph and Robert Forison and Paul Rubach, and that he has learned a few things, and he might either think again about that, or he might absolutely take a different approach to Mark Weber if he comes on his program again. And that's what I would hope, that he would make Mark Weber answer for this. Now, I'm sure that there are differences of opinion as to whether Mark Weber should have to answer for some of the things, these things that I'm bringing up. You know, Mark Weber's failure at the IHR and bringing it to the state of do-nothingness and nobody there and nothing happening is more serious than what I've made it sound so far. And I went into that more in the article, so I feel like I don't have to cover that again. But he tries to say that, oh, we have lots of things going on here. No! He puts on a couple of talks at the Institute office there a year, maybe, and maybe 10 people show up and listen to him and some guest speaker he gets, and there's these people who are always, you know, interested in this, and that's the only people he gets. He's not reaching out. He's not reaching people. He's not accomplishing anything. But I want to say that Kyle Hunt has talked about this white man's march a little bit idea that he had, and I think that's a really good idea, and I hope it happens. I saw that he was doing another show on this, and I think that's very, very admirable that he is trying to, sponsor or support something like that. And it's very difficult. I'm not holding my breath that he would be able to do it, but, actually accomplish it. But at least he's talking like that, and he's putting out the effort. So I think that's very worthwhile. I want to mention that a commenter at the White Network, since I posted that article about Mark Weber on the blog there, he wrote something, and this is a man who's, every time I talk or write about Mark Weber, he responds. He has quite a lot of knowledge about, he's not somebody, I don't know his real name, but he has quite a bit of knowledge about what went on there. And he said this will give readers an insight into what sort of person Mark Weber really is. And he tells us that it was the late revisionist Bill Curry's dying wish that Weber write the book Final Solution - Legend and Reality. We have so many books titled Legend and Reality, but this is another one that was probably, this is back in time some, so there probably weren't so many at that time at the same title. You know, I've talked about, and you should know that Weber was always saying he was writing a book, and the book never got written, and that he was given money from somebody. Well, this is the situation. It's this Bill Curry who let Weber stay at his Nebraska home, and I think he stayed there for quite a while, lived there free of charge, and with probably a room of his own and everything, he was, so that he would write this book. And he also gave him a stipend, financial, meaning, you know, regular income for Mark, and Mark accepted all that. And what Curry asked in return was that Mark finish this book and publish it before he died, before Curry died. He was an older man already. And so Mark stayed there, and he was supposed to be working on the book. He told everybody he was working on the book, but he didn't get, he never completed it. And people say that he didn't write hardly any of it, but he did say on, I believe it was on Deanna Spingola's show, because she knew about it, but Kyle Hunt, I don't think, doesn't know about it, about this story, that he did answer that question with Deanna Spingola, and he said that, oh, well, he finished quite a few chapters. And then he published the chapters as articles. And he didn't say what articles they were. I think he mentioned, he said one, or he said the basic, one of them that he published was on the Third Reich cooperation with the Zionists on the moving Jews to Israel, that thing. So he's got, he published an article on that, which was supposed to be in the book. And he says that there are some other articles from his chapters that he completed, but he doesn't say what they are. And a lot of people say he didn't complete really anything except one chapter. So I don't know if he's being honest. I, of course, can't say for sure one way or the other, but I doubt that that Mark is being honest. Now, let's see what more I have here. I want to finish this in this hour. Oh, I'm doing real well here. Okay. Mark Weber was on Deanna Spingola's show a year ago, well, more than a year ago, sometime in 2012. And I re-listened to that yesterday, I think. And he said on there that Anne Frank was rounded up because she was Jewish. And he says things like that. He's really sympathetic to the Jews when it comes to Holocaust. Even when he was on, I guess it was in the 90s, on these TV shows, these TV debates that he's been given a lot of credit for. But with one was he was some sort of a debate with Michael Shermer. Like all these debates, they never function as real debates. But anyway, they were debating back and forth, supposedly, and on one of these programs. And then on another one, he was with Bradley Smith. And there's quite a bit on YouTube about this one. I haven't looked at it recently. But I felt, and I always felt about Mark Weber, that he was not tough enough in defense of the truth about Germany, and that he was always giving too much to the Jews. He was intimidated by the Jews that are on there, and he feels he has to agree with them. You know, we're going to talk more about that agreement thing in the second hour. He has to agree with them to some degree. He can't just, you know, deny things. He's unable to do that, even if it would be the truth. But he can't do it. He's incapable of doing it. And Robert Faurisson, who's a very distinguished revisionist writer and professor, in that article he wrote, when he called on Mark Weber to resign, after Mark Weber wrote his article and ended it by saying that revisionism should not be any kind of a main focus for not only the Institute, but for anybody anymore, and that because it was has turned out to be more of a hindrance than a help. He didn't really explain that too well, but that was his final conclusion there, and it upset all the revisionists and shocked everybody and surprised them, because he didn't give any warning that he was going to write something like that and take this position. Because up till then, these revisionists, still thought that Mark was a friend of revisionism and a friend of theirs, and that they had some, although they had some problems with him, but that they had some input, and that he was, you know, he would listen to them. And at this, he let it be known that he was not going to listen to them anymore, and that he was taking the Institute in another direction. And when they questioned him about it, he just wouldn't even really respond. He just wouldn't answer in any kind of a decent way. And so Faurisson wrote this article saying that Weber should resign. And as I would say right now, this is the right position to take, that nobody is saying that Mark Weber should lay down and die or something, or that he needs to go to jail or something, but that he can continue to write. If he's such a great writer and historian and so on, why doesn't he work at it and earn a living by it? Why does he want to sit there taking in whatever the IHR brings in each year, which is all he's been doing for the last 20 years? So he can continue his writing. He might even continue writing for the IHR and get paid for what he does if it had a new director and somebody who would get things going again the way they should be, the way they used to be. Now, the thing with Weber is that he wrote things when he was just a writer on the staff there. And other people were the director and so on. And he was paid something. He earned his living there. But he had to write things to do it. Once he took over, once he became the director, more and more he didn't write anything until he stopped writing. He hasn't written anything for so long, except he's written a few podcasts. He's, you know, he makes some podcasts, but this is all material he's already got there, and it's not that difficult. But he does do a real good job in organizing this information and making making things clear to people. So, you know, there's things he can do, but he would have to work, and that's the problem with him. He doesn't want to work. Anyway, Forison told this story about he had come to the United States, and he was traveling around and, you know, meeting people and doing things with Bradley Smith, and Mark Weber was along, and a large part of the time it was those three, and they had kind of taken Mark Weber into their circle, and Mark, they had high hopes for Mark Weber because he seemed to be totally turned on to what they were doing in revisionism. And he was all gung-ho, and he had his master's in history, and he was a good writer. And so they, you know, they were going around together, and at one point they went to a dinner with some people that Mark knew. I think it was around in New York somewhere, but I'm not sure. It doesn't matter. And with some friends, and, you know, who were open-minded but weren't convinced or anything. They weren't really revisionists, and maybe some of them were not so open-minded. But they were a kind of a large party there, a large group, at somebody's home. And, of course, the conversation came around to things, and somebody finally asked Mark point-blank, do you not believe in the gas chambers? Are you saying there weren't any gas chambers and the Jews weren't gassed? And Robert Forison expected Mark, because they'd already been talking about it, to say, yes, that's what I believe, that they weren't. There were no gas chambers. And Mark did not say that. Mark said, well, I'm not saying that. I'm not sure. I don't know. He was hedging around. And Robert Forison said he was so totally shocked, he was so disgusted, he couldn't even continue to eat. And he said, he attributes it, in his mind, there's no doubt that it was pure cowardice on the part of Mark Weber, that he just couldn't stand up to these people. You know, he couldn't say that in the way that he should have said it. And this is the truth about Mark Weber. This is why he doesn't belong being director of the Institute of Historical Review. And he's been a disaster as a director. And of course, well, I've gone into all that in my program. So let me go on here a few minutes I have left here. So he's saying, even on Spengola's show, that Anne Frank was rounded up because she was Jewish. And then he said that was German policy. And Weber clearly disapproves of his policy toward Jews. I don't know what he thought was supposed to be done with the Jews, but he makes it very clear all the time that he thinks this was too harsh, not right, and it was not a good idea to have this policy toward Jews. And he then said, I think some Jews were gassed at Belzec, Sobibor, and Treblinka. These camps, you see, have not been investigated like the others were by Leuchter and Rudolph, because there was nothing there anymore. So even though there's nothing there anymore and there's nothing to investigate, he decides to believe that they had gas chambers there and Jews were gassed there. And he said, my view on this is similar but not identical with David Irving's. And there again, he's just following what David Irving is saying. And so we'll be back in 5 minutes, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you. Well, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm trying to get my page narrowed down, which I failed to do before the show started, but I didn't get it all done. This is the Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager tonight, and it is December 2nd, and I'm talking about the narrow way and the wide way to go, and I've been covering Mark Weber, and I'm not going to say any more at this time about Mark Weber, because I want to get on to my have the whole next hour to talk about this whole thing going on with John Friend. And I'm not trying to just jump in and join in the battle that is between other people, but I have had a problem with John Friend for a long time, and I haven't said anything about it because I really don't, it doesn't sound very good and so on, so I had decided after, some days ago to do this, and then this debate thing came up, which I was really glad of, and I did listen to that debate with Mike Delaney, so-called debate. Not much of a debate, but Mike Delaney and Scott Roberts and John Friend and another fellow named Tom, who was supposed to be with John Friend, debating his side. And it was just supposed to be about the 9/11, rather the no planes theory and the Simon Shack theories about everything being fake and done in the studio and so on, had any merit. And of course it got into a little bit more than that, well, especially afterwards. And now John wrote a blog about it. As soon as it was over, he left the debate early and wrote this, posted this blog, I understand, which I have here. And got a number of comments, and then Andrew Englund wrote about it at Daily Stormer, and there's a whole lot of comments there. And it's kind of like on John Friend's site, people are standing up for John more, and on Daily Stormer, people are not standing up for John. Not to, you know, get into low life journalism here. I hope I'm not. I don't want to do that, but I'll just have to give you some background here that John Friend has always been friendly to me, and not that I've had anything to do with him, but he's wanted to be friendly with me, and I just could not ever bring myself to be friendly with him because things about him always bothered me. I never liked his style, or his agreeableness was so great, and I just never liked particularly what he was doing. At first, you know, I was just neutral about it, but then as little time went on, I developed this feeling. And I did eventually come to suspect that John Friend has Jewish ancestry, because Friend is a Jewish name. And a lot of Jews use the name Friend. And then there are a lot of Christians or non-Jews, but I suspect that these people were very likely were Jews who converted to Christianity at some point back when, and kept that name Friend, because this is a name like Goodman and Goodson, you know, and Friend, and then there was that guy Friendly who ran CBS, he was Jewish. These are names that Jews have selected. And you don't find Germans, in German it's Freund, and it supposedly comes from that. But, you don't find, or you just say you don't find Gentiles or Aryans much naming themselves something like this. They don't name themselves Friend, but Jews do. And so there was no proof about that. I mentioned it to a couple of people and they didn't think much of it. And so I knew that, but I couldn't explain John Friend's behavior and the way he talked and so on, which always bothered me. And so I just kept up with this, he might be Jewish, but that's not the most important part, because whether he's Jewish or isn't Jewish, he's really a problem in this movement and not an asset, as most people thought and many people still think. But what's happened now has really brought things into focus, which I'm very happy about. I'm not a part of this. I'm not a part of this circle with these young guys who talk together and so on. And I don't want to be, but I'm certainly not. And I don't pretend that I am or that I should have something to say about it. And sometimes I think, well, I don't really care. But I do care about how National Socialism and Adolf Hitler particularly are presented. And I also care about how the Holocaust is presented. And so that's where I get into my issues here. I don't so much care about what he's doing or not doing to white nationalism and so on. Although I think that he's probably now put himself outside the bounds of being a white nationalist. And I never did believe that he was one. I never believed he was really anything that he says. He was just wanted to get involved in these things, wanted to get involved with these people, and everything he sees that he's interested in, he wants to join up with that too. So he's now all buddy-buddy with Simon Schack, who people are saying is a Jew, and I thought that a long time ago, and I for a while was reading his Clues for him. Yeah, it is September Clues is the name of his film. And about the Sandy Hook, I got very much into the Sandy Hook, and I don't believe things happened the way they say. I though couldn't say that all those children were fake, were made up, and nothing at all happened in that school. Although it's very strange what they say happened in that school and what they've done since, and the cover up and how there's no evidence of anything. I agree with that. But then they've taken it to everything. 9/11, totally fake. Let me just say, John Friend has taken up, this is the way I see it, the following subjects in the past year. It seems like in the past year, he was already involved in 9/11 truth. But in the past year, he became, or maybe a little bit more, but not much, became a convert to Adolf Hitler, World War II revisionism and Holocaust revisionism, Christian identity and ancient Aryan history, those go together, early American history for the past 300 years or so, and then, along with linking up kind of with the 9/11 truth, Sandy Hook. He got into that a lot. Then other conspiracy theories, including Boston bombing. Then there was the London beheading. And he got further and further along in this everything is fake and actors and so on. And then he's even gone into the JFK assassination. And of course, you can't say that the JFK assassination was all fake. Nobody died. I don't think so. He hasn't tried to say that, but it's an awful lot of stuff that he jumps into. And what this tells me is that there's just nothing that he sees that he doesn't like, or if he finds it interesting, he wants to get into it. And that's all right. He can actually do what he wants, but if he's going to be seen as some kind of a leader amongst white or a principal spokesman or someone to pay attention to, in the white nationalist movement and also in the Hitler Holocaust area and so on, and then in every other area. Well, he needs to be more of an expert than he is, but he's a kind of a, like I said before, I was saying that about about Mark Weber, but when it comes to John Friend, to me, he is a serious copycat, and he's a good mimic, and he picks things up. And he just, whatever he sees, he takes that on himself, and he repeats it, and he wants to talk about it and talk to people about it and so on. So he does all these things on his radio show. But that's what bothered me first about John Friend, is that I thought he was a copycat, and I saw him copying me in a lot of ways. You can never prove that somebody's copying you, but it seemed pretty he says, as soon as I would do certain things, I would see him doing it. And you know, one of the biggest things that he copied that I can mention, not from me, but from Andrew Anglin, was as soon as Andrew Anglin started his Fascist Friday wrap-up on his Total Fascism website, John Friend almost immediately started on Friday posting news from the Jews and having a bunch of stories that he, you know, picked up during the week and wrote about it. And I was just, seemed pretty obvious that he got that, he did that because of what Andrew Anglin was doing. And I think Andrew Anglin is the person that John Friend most wants to be friends with and most wants to have the good opinion of, most wants to associate himself with in amongst this kind of group of people, pro-white, strongly pro-white, anti-Jew people, young people, youngish. And he so much wants to be connected with Andrew Anglin that Andrew Anglin has not been able to see him. Just, you know, he thinks he's harmless and he's been a good, you know, he just has blind spots and he can't, he's naive or he's something like that. He makes all these excuses for him. And instead of seeing some of the problems in what things that John is saying and doing. So let me go into some of that. Well, I guess first I should talk about the debate just a little bit that leads into it. I don't need to talk about it much. I thought that John tried to run the show in the beginning, and he was there by himself, and he didn't seem to mind. He didn't try to get his friend Tom to come on. I think there's all kinds of things he wanted to say, and he wanted Mike and Scott to give him the time to go through his whole presentation, which probably would have taken 15, 20 minutes, or if not longer, before they said anything, and then they could do theirs. Well, I don't think he would have let, you know, he was breaking in all the time to what they were saying, so I don't know. And Mike, though, wouldn't allow that. Good for Mike. And he said, I need to answer some of these things after you, some of your points after each point. I'm not going to wait till you go through all your points. And they kind of argued about that, but finally John realized he had to give in to that. Now, I want to say that I think the best performance on that debate was Mike Delaney, because Mike Delaney came straight out with what he really thought and what his real concerns were, and didn't hedge around, but he wasn't rude. He didn't do it in any kind of a hostile way, but he said what he thought was the problem, and that was Jews being so well tolerated by John Friend. John tried to deny that Simon Schack was Jewish, whereas he doesn't even know, but Simon Schack says he's not, so John accepted that. I want to mention some things about some connections of John Friend with Jews. Along with Simon Schack and his friendship with Jim Fetzer, Jim Fetzer is not Jewish. However, Jim Fetzer is never been anti-Jewish, and he's never been any, he's always been anti-Nazi, actually, and goes along with all these crazy anti-Nazi conspiracy people. And has had them on his program, Jim Mars, and I don't want to go through the whole list, but every one of them. I mean, he goes into that really a lot, and yet John Friend says, oh, I admire and respect Jim Fetzer very much because of all the good work he's done all these years. What good work? How can he not know? He totally ignores all this other stuff that Fetzer has been doing, and says he thinks so much of Fetzer's just because he's of his 9/11 work and his JFK work and so on. And yet all it does is keep us from looking at the real important issues by looking for forever and forever at how was this thing done? You know, how was it done? How was it done? And it doesn't matter. Things are set up in these events to make you go in the wrong directions about how it was done. And you never get anywhere with it. And also, gatekeepers are put in there. And so it's just, it's an endless argument that goes on. And it's never solved. It never will be solved. They won't allow it to be solved. So that is a waste of time. And all Fetzer has done is contribute to this wasting of time rather than getting down to the real problems, which is why it's all done and what it's all done for. And now John thinks he's getting into that, that it's all done to, well, I'll tell you that when I get back to the Holocaust. But I also want to mention, though, very important to me, that on I noticed looking over his blog this past week that on November 26th, John had a program, I forget now which program, whatever program was on November 26th, and he linked to Henry Mackow, Jew Henry Mackow's website, an article on there, for no good reason. I mean, it was clear to me that there was no good reason for doing this. He was talking to someone, and I think they were talking about pornography and how pornography is used to destroy our culture and so on, you know. And we're all familiar with that, although there's no reason you can't talk about it. But he linked to this article about pornography on Henry Mackow's site, and the title of the article was "Illuminati Uses Porn to Destroy White Values." It had nothing new in it. It was just a lot of sickening pictures. And then Henry Mackow's website now has a bunch of advertising down the left side. And while it's not pornography, it has a look of pornography. I mean, it's really ugly stuff. Little, you know, one ad after another, just really, you know, in your face kind of blasting stuff to make you look at it about just ads, but really ugly. So this Henry Mackow just can't get enough money either. He's already got plenty of money, but he's always was asking for donations big time on his site. And now he's selling advertising big time, ugly stuff that you must get more money for the ugly stuff than you get for the nice stuff. And, why anybody would go there, I don't know. He is 100% Jew, Henry Mackow is, and he's been pushing this. He hates Hitler because he's Polish. He's a Polish Jew. He's always hated Hitler, and he's always featured these articles about Hitler was a British agent, and was Hitler as a Jew, Hitler was a Zionist, and that whole range of things that come up. He posts and publishes all those things. And John Fred has to know that. But yet, he thinks that it's good to link, for people listening to his program, they should go and read this article by Henry Mackow, which really, as I said, had nothing new in it, nothing to recommend it. And then he commented along with his link. John said, I know he's a shill, but he says some good things. Not a word about him being a Jew. Now, I think that is just, some people might think, oh, well, he just says that. You know, that he's just kind of silly sometimes. He's kind of stupid. Well, that's not it. He's not that stupid. I don't believe it. For one thing, he calls him a shill. Henry Mackow doesn't fit the description of a shill. He's not shilling for anyone. He believes all this stuff. He's a Polish Jew. He doesn't like the culture of the West, but at the same time, he hates National Socialism and everything to do with Hitler. So, you know, that's where he's coming from. He's not a shill. And he says some good things. Yeah, he says some good things mixed in with all the bad things. So that's pure disinfo, and you don't have to be working for somebody to put out disinfo, and he probably doesn't even think it's disinfo. He probably believes it all. It's just questionable why John would link to that for no good reason. And another time he linked to a Jew for no good reason, I remember an earlier time, I can't say exactly when it was, but I had mentioned it to Bill Fink, and I remember doing that. It was at least 2 months ago, probably longer ago than that. And Bill was surprised because I told him how it was done. And again, he had a post there or something, and he said, well, it wouldn't hurt you to go, or it'd be good for you to go and look at this. And I don't know if it was a particular article on Mike Rivero's site, you know, the what really happened, or if it was just Mike Rivero's site. I don't remember. But he had a link there to it. And, of course, Mike Rivero is a Jew. And he's another one who hates Adolf Hitler. I mean, he constantly badmouths the Third Reich, the Nazis. You know, they are no good. He's constantly reminding us that the Nazis started the Reichstag fire so that they could take over the government with a lot of repressive measures and so on. That's Mike Rivero. And for no good reason, he was linked to by John Friend. And it was done in a way I thought like you would do for a friend of yours. You know, if you, I'm going to, you know, I have these people I like and, you know, I'll link to them as whenever I have the opportunity and hope that they'll return the favor and link back to you. That's the impression I got from it. And I don't get paranoid ideas about things. I have a pretty good sense of things and these things really struck me. John Friend also recently wrote a glowing review on Amazon for, I don't know how recent it was actually, but I just saw it. Well, it couldn't have been too long ago because it was Veronica Clark's book on Himmler and Hitler. And I don't have time to go into that story, and I'm not sure I should because it's something I learned from someone who personal experience about this book with Veronica Clark. And he didn't give me, I didn't ask him either. I don't have permission to repeat it, so I better not do it. But Veronica Clark has recently taken on this really anti-white position, and she's always been pushing multiculturalism for Adolf Hitler. She's like has this love affair for Adolf Hitler, but she wants him to be a multicultural hero. She wants him to be a friend of the blacks. She herself is very friendly. She's from Southern California, like John Friend is. She's very friendly with, and always has been, I mean, this goes way back, with blacks and Hispanics. She particularly likes those two groups. She does hate Jews. She doesn't like Jews. She's anti-Jewish, and she's kind of probably anti-Muslim. I think she was Christian, very much so. And she was promoting Hitler as in her early websites as a Christian and a friend to all these different races and the Arabs and of course some black Africans and so on. She wrote the book, Black Nazis, and she found a handful of blacks who were being treated nicely by the Wehrmacht troops or even maybe some SS troops, I'm not sure, in North Africa, and they gave them some uniforms and put them into little lineups and so on, troops, and supposedly they were helping out. It didn't hurt to make friends with these people, but it was no big thing. And Veronica makes a big thing out of it. Now Veronica has a book called Hitler's Diverse Military, something like that. And the cover has pictures of all these non-whites, including a black man and an Oriental Asian man and some Arab-looking people. And even worse than that, some kind of, I don't know, kind of rough-looking guys with dark skin in various Wehrmacht uniforms. And then Hitler's face is there, too. And, you know, this is all kind of sick stuff. And she's lately now come out and just really attacking whites. She claims that white nationalists are attacking her, and I don't believe it. She's always been claiming that she's being attacked by people, and I don't believe it because other people are not being attacked. But she, for some reason, wanted to put up websites that were covered with swastikas all over the place and things like that, you know, and made up millions of pictures of Adolf Hitler. And so on. And then she wonders if she's going to be attacked a little bit. Anyway, that's another one that John Friend has connected himself with. So now I need to go back to my real gripe with John now. And my real disagreement is that he is saying that he calls it the Hola hoax. That's okay. He says the Hola hoax was a psyop, you know, and he's saying that 9/11 and the Hola hoax were psyops, and they follow the same pattern and so on. And this is his one and only discovery of his own that he can make claim to, and he's been pushing this, and he's just absolutely wrong, because the Holocaust was not a psyop. It doesn't fit the definition of a psyop. He says it's like an exact pre-runner of 9/11, and he thinks he's going to make converts that way by saying that he's going to make 9/11 people, he might be imagining this, make 9/11 people accept the Hula hoax because it's a pre-runner of 9/11. Well, he's kind of dreaming. I used what he wrote on his recent blog about the Mike Delaney and Scott Roberts debate, and he really showed a different side of himself. It's actually not the first time he showed this, but he showed it worse, like he has no restraint, because as soon as that he left that debate before it was over, and then his friend Tom got on and went on for a couple more hours, which I got bored with and quit listening finally. John writes on his blog, "This debate," in quotes, "turned out to be an utter disaster for the most part." Well, you know, John was the disaster. It was John's disaster, but he's too narcissistic to say that it was his disaster. He has to blame it on to mostly Mike, but Mike and Scott. And he writes, "The only thing it really demonstrated is how immature, dishonest, unprofessional, and egotistical Mike Delaney truly is, and how ignorant both Mike and Scott Roberts are when it comes to the research September Clues has presented." Well, you know, I've been listening to John and use that word immature about anybody who doesn't say nice things about him or whatever. And they're always immature. And he writes that a lot, too. Oh, I don't be. He even has that at the bottom of his comment section, that you're welcome to comment. He'll post your comment as long as you stay mature. He accuses people. He's implying that he considers himself to be supremely mature about everything, because he doesn't attack people. And anybody who attacks is just so immature. Well, now he's attacking Mike Delaney, who really was only doing what he should have been doing in that debate, and saying that he's immature. And not only that, but unprofessional and egotistical. And you know who, it's just like, it's like that psychological thing where you turn things around and you call the other person, you know, what you're doing, what you are. So, this does not make John look too good, and I'm surprised he lost himself to the extent that he said something like this, because he's made a point of being agreeable all the time with everyone. And that's one of the things that bugged me about him, because when he would be on radio programs with people or have people on his radio program, he would constantly say, "I agree with you. I agree. I agree. Oh, I agree with that." Over and over again. And that's about the only contribution he made that was the largest contribution he made. And then he, you know, comment on what that person said that he agreed with. But now he says in this blog, "A main point I was trying to emphasize in this program is that the 9/11 PSYOP essentially follows the same template as the fake Holocaust PSYOP." Well, you can ask, why does it? And he says, as I guess some kind of an answer for why he thinks this, he says, "Both involve extreme psychological trauma." You know how many things involve trauma, ladies and gentlemen, besides these two events? But what he has come up with, that these two things are the same because they're both using trauma. They're both used to traumatize the public, average citizens, and so on. My view is that the Holocaust was war propaganda. It was not a PSYOP. It wasn't dreamed up ahead of time. We're going to create this Holocaust, and we're going to put it out there, and we're going to spread it around in the news and so on, and we're going to traumatize everybody by showing pictures of it and so on. Anything like that came later. What they call the Holocaust is just what Mark Weber finds so difficult to deal with, and that is the Germans deporting, or the National Socialists say, the German government deporting the Jews finally out of Germany. They started out taking Jews out of positions of power and influence in the country, and they're also trying to get Jews to emigrate, in particular to Israel, because they thought that was a good place for them, but anywhere they would immigrate. But they weren't very successful with that. because, you know, enough considering the number of Jews there were. But they did get them out of positions of power and influence in Germany. But then when the New World Order governments decided to, they were going to just go ahead and wage war on Germany, and the United States was largely behind it all, and they promised they would come into the war so that they would win in the end. And then Germany was forced to invade the Soviet Union or be invaded itself. So then it made the Soviet Union their enemy. So then the U.S. and Britain got friendly with Stalin. And then they were all, you know, ganged up on Germany. At that point, they felt, the Hitler government and Hitler felt they had to move a lot of these Jews out of their living space because there were all these partisans in Russia, in the Soviet Union, fighting against them, all these Jews who were fighting as partisans, as illegal fighters, and caught in doing a lot of damage to the troops and to their supplies and so on. Then they had all these Jews still in Germany and in the general government and so on, and they thought that this was very dangerous for them, and so they needed to move them out. And so they went into this huge program to start doing that and try to do that. And that is what the Holocaust was made up, was built upon, this movement of Jews and the camps that they were put in and so on, because they didn't know exactly where to move them all to. And then they needed workers. As the war went on, they desperately needed labor. So then they decided to use them for labor. And this is how this whole Holocaust came about. That's what it's based on. So it wasn't a decision like 9/11 to create this fake PSYOP. It's nothing like that. And when John says these things, he's not only talking stupidly, but he's twisting the facts in order to be, I guess, the author of a good theory or something, is to get credit for coming up with something that maybe a lot of people will believe and will repeat and follow and so on. Now, there was what you might call some PSYOP activity in creating photographs, fake photographs, and altering photographs, and creating these movies, with Jewish directors and so on out of Hollywood, which made things look differently than they really were. And you could call that a PSYOP, but you can't call the whole thing a PSYOP in the same sense that of 9/11. And so I don't know if this is just innocent irresponsibility and lack of scholarship on John Friend's part, if he's just so anxious to write stuff and say stuff, and he is, to have something to say about all these things that he's gotten into, or if there's something more to it. But even if I think that he is could very well be part Jewish, or that doesn't mean that he's working for Jews, and he's not even conscious of it himself. He probably doesn't believe that it's true about himself, and maybe it isn't. You know, I can't prove it. But I will say that when I looked at these photographs that he lately posted on his blog at the JFK conference in Santa Barbara, and he put a bunch of, you know, I was looking over his blog, and I saw all this, and he put a bunch of pictures of himself. And he's getting a little older. I think he's not 30 years old yet, but he looks like he's put on weight. He looks kind of big, you know. He used to look kind of young and real slender, and I thought he looked better looking then, but he looks a little more Jewish now. He's gotten heavier, and his features seem a little coarser or something, and he looks like he'd fit right in Tel Aviv. But that really doesn't mean anything. That's just an impression that I have. But all this friendship with Jews. And then he goes on in his blog, his latest blog article, that he mentions this Lenin honor again. And that Lenin honor, that black man who he had on his show a couple times, who talks about psychological traumatizing events and wrote a book. And John was really plugging this book, and as if no one ever has written anything that he could do instead of this, but he thinks that this is the best one he's ever read or something. And so this Lenin honor, the black man, was brought up on the debate just a few hours earlier, or an hour earlier, in a sense. And they were criticizing him for having this black guy on. If John was really a white nationalist, why would he do such a thing? And John was defending himself against it, and he was acting like he didn't really care about Lenin honor, but he thought he should give him the credit for the work, because he was using his work. And then he gets right back, and he starts pushing Lenin honor again in this blog. And he talks about this psychologically traumatizing event, and, you know, what makes up the fake Holocaust, he says, and 9/11, and these things that Lenin honor has talked about. So I believe, getting back to my theme of, or my title of this show, of the narrow road versus the wide avenue, and what I said earlier about it, that if we're going to avoid destruction, and we're getting very close to destruction, the idea that, well, we have to accept all people who seem to want to be a part of this movement, because we don't have very many people, and so, you know, we shouldn't be criticizing people. But if you really take a look at what some people are saying, it doesn't come together. It really doesn't come together. And either there's a problem that they have with being on the narrow road. They say that they want to be on the narrow road. They say that they want to save the white race. They say that they're doing all these things. But I think a lot of these people are so Judaized. We are so used to the Judaic culture that we live in and all the things that are available, and we don't want to narrow ourselves down. I don't have enough time. I'm going to miss out here. I want to talk about Fetzer and Barrett in this book about the white rose. But let me just say before I get into that, if you compare the narrow road to, let's say, National Socialist Germany, because the general consensus today is that it was terrible to live there, that they weren't allowed to do anything. They were told what to do. They couldn't read any book they wanted. They couldn't go anywhere they wanted. They couldn't associate with whoever they wanted. They were discouraged from associating with Jews, even though Jews were still living there. And things like that are looked upon as like some kind of terrible deprivation of happiness, things that make you happy. They didn't have big Jewish department stores. They didn't have Jewish movies anymore, but what they proved was that what they had that was Aryan, what they had that was pure German, was really good. You know, they had great movies. They had nice stores. They had a whole fashion industry. They competed with the rest of the world in everything, and they did it as Aryans. It wasn't Jewish. But we're convinced, you know, or we're told, that if you don't have the Jews around, you're not going to have all this good stuff that we like, you know, and a lot of people like this Jewish culture and really don't want to give it up and don't give it up. And so they pull it along with them. You know, they want to keep a lot of it. And that's how I see John with all his friends and his connections to all these Jews and so on. He really is not able at this point to give these things up. And I think that he has demonstrated that he's not fit to continue to be a friend and a partner in these endeavors, not only in the white nationalist movement, but even in my view, in revisionism and talking about Germany and, Hitler. You know, he loves to quote Mein Kampf and so on. Well, he can do that. I mean, he can do anything he wants, but he shouldn't be accepted as someone who is speaking our language. And that's just my opinion. And I hope it turns out that way. Now, as I was talking about how he's so chummy with Jim Fetzer, and, you know, I discovered something in this, doing this show, that I did not know about the latest thing about Jim Fetzer and Kevin Barrett. You know, I've talked about them before, and I have this thing about those two, But then after the last time I did, I just forgot about them. And I don't want to follow everything that these people are doing. I'm not spying on people or going around trying to see what they're up to. I've totally ignored them. But then when I do that, it turns out that there's some things that I miss. And I miss this book. I'm glad I found out about it because I'm really interested in the White Rose Society. And, you know, I've done some shows on it. I'd like to do more. It's just so interesting because, again, the information we're given here and all over in this, in our great democracies, is that the White Rose group, these young people, young students in their 20s were just, oh, the great heroes and heroines, and they stood up to that fascist Hitler government, which was so terrible, and they put out these leaflets, they risked their lives, and then they were executed, and they're just, they're symbolic of everything that's good and right about democracy. And nothing could be, just isn't that way if you are not looking at it from loving democracy and loving the American way and the Jewish way. These White Rose group people, they were really soft on the Jews. They were worried about the Jews. They were basically communists. And they are supported. They were using communist information and sources. You know, they were young Germans. It's true. They were, but they were brainwashed by the left, or they were on the left. I mean, that's all I can say. I don't agree with the left for some time now. So I don't see anybody on the left as doing anything heroic. And I see these people as guilty of treason against their own country, because I believe that the government, Hitler's government in power, was totally legitimate. And the great majority of Germans thought so and followed it and supported Hitler. And this whole idea that there are hundreds of thousands or something of people who against Hitler, but who were afraid to say so. They couldn't open their mouth or the Gestapo was going to drag them to a dungeon somewhere. That just isn't the way it was. But anyway, this guy named Mike Palachek, who is a Czech, I found out. That's a Czech name. And the Czechs, like the Poles, cannot forgive, cannot ever come to terms with National Socialists and Hitler. And they might think okay of the Germans now, these kind of Germans we have today, but not those Germans. And they're always against that. And so he got this idea to compare Jim Fetzer and Kevin Barrett, who have in the past called themselves a dynamic duo because they had a radio program together, to compare them to the White Rose Society group in what he calls Nazi Germany. And, you know, these are a couple old guys, but he's trying to make them into some kind of heroes. I mean, the dynamic duo is a couple of old guys. But he's saying that they represent the American resistance against the American empire. That is, he calls fascist in warmongering, just like the White Rose group resisted Hitler, who was fascist and warmongering and so on. And he approached them, said he wanted to write a book about them in this way. And they were delighted and they were quite happy about it, and they cooperated fully. And they knew that he was going to compare them with the White Rose Society. Well, there's stories about how they took pictures for him to use and so on. And anyway, there's no way to think that Jim Fetzer didn't know that he was going to be compared with White Rose in Germany. And that is his position. And here again, again you have John Friend admiring and looking up to Fetzer so much for his work another thing that John did that I think was dishonest was when it was brought up to him that he posted a link to this book, which is called, did I ever give the title of this book? Maybe I don't have it. I think the title of it is The Dynamic Duo. In this book, Palachek also writes a whole bunch of stuff in here. And he writes about the Reichstag fire, and he quotes from the Wikipedia about the Reichstag fire, and he quotes from Sefton Delmar, who was a British propagandist posing as a journalist, and he quotes from William Shirer, that horrible guy that wrote The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, and full of lies. And he's also a journalist living in, an American journalist in Germany. After the war, and they're doing all this work for the Americans, all this propaganda. And Fetzer knows all this, and he goes along with all this. I think I'm going to have to forget what Fetzer wrote. I need to close with my good article that I found to explain my approach to this whole program tonight, which naturally I didn't have enough time to do properly. But this is a 1931 interview of Adolf Hitler by a Jew who was posing as a German, a regular German. His name was Max Frankel, and supposedly he had blonde hair and blue eyes, and he found Hitler in a kind of a restaurant beer hall with a group of his associates, and he was talking, and the whole place was listening to what he had to say, and he went up and asked him if he could do an interview, and Hitler looked at him and thought, well, he thought he was a German, and so he granted him an interview, and some of the things that Hitler said fit exactly, and I hope I can get this in. He said the only way in which Germans who have become infected with Judeophilia can be saved is by labeling everything un-German Jewish. He said, I intend to do nothing against the Jews except carry on the educational campaign I have prosecuted during the last few years. This is 1931. But whatever this National Socialist Party will do to carry out its political program, it will do in a constitutional way. German life must be purged of all foreign elements that distort the true German spirit. Well, I thought I could easily substitute Aryan for German in this to speak to everyone here. And, you know, all the people who are involved in this movement of truth. So he's saying that you have to purge all foreign elements and all Jewish elements from that distort the true Aryan spirit, and they have to remove them from the society. The other thing he said is that Jews have nothing to fear from us as long as they do not mix with us. Think about that. They're in our society still, but they're not supposed to be mixing with us. And he says, as long as the Jews here will not try to pose as Germans and have the temerity to speak for Germans, they will be unmolested. And that's all I have to say on the subject, he said. So I think this is a good model for us to use, that we have to remove all these elements if we're going to save ourselves. And the Germans did save themselves. For a time, anyway. That's all, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for listening.